Session number 10934, Rule 8.
General Rawl relays.
Okay, there we had to lay 1 meter apart in the open air. And we were lucky enough there was no rain at that time. But there was also no food that time, you know. And I can't blame anybody because the number of prisoners was way beyond the capability to feed them all. So we had tremendous attrition. Every day we had about 12 dead people, and we just get them up. One day, after maybe 1 week or 2 weeks, the American CIC came and said, all Air Force officers have to stay in line, okay? Then a man came and he called some names, and he called my name, Rawl, and we went apart. We were about 8 or 6. And then he asked me, we know who you are. And he knew more than I knew about me. He knew the number of victories, and he knew where I was engaged, and his front line, and what I did, and wounded, and everything. And then he asked me, we know you flew the 262. Are you willing to help us to establish a jet force? You know, ask him, a pilot in a prison camp, the answer was yes. Yeah, where do you want to go? Do you want to go to England or to the United States? He's like, to the United States, as far as possible. Okay, and his last question was, never forget this. He's like, would you be willing to fight with us against the Japanese? And there I said, no. Why? No. This was a former allies. I can't do that. But the other one, okay.
Why did you choose America rather than Britain?
You know, this was the great adventure to go across the ocean. I have been there. You know, this was just an expectation which never was fulfilled. You know, we came to England then.
When you first saw the American forces, what impression did they make on you?
Oh, it was a very well-equipped. A little bit of sloppy, but anyhow, well-equipped, well-fed force. There was no fighting anymore. They were coming in with the jeeps, you know, and good-looking guys and well-fed, not these lousy, you know, troops we were after 5.5 years, yeah? Yeah, from there I was taken then to Heidelberg, Wiesbaden, and finally we ended up in Latimer, in England, northwest of England, London, I think. This was the interrogation camp. And there we were treated very well. The war was over, and we were a matter of interest to our American. You know, the camp was run by the British Army or British forces. But the interrogators were Americans because we were American prisoners. And the questions were around about our tactics and about very special aviation problems and about the 262. And we were three of us in one very small cell, and we knew exactly where the mic. Microphones were built in, you know, you could. it was of no interest because the war was over. There was senseless to have a secret. We talked free and openly about these things. Okay, and then after a while, we were taken down to Morton, and from Morton to Southampton, and put on a Liberty ship and shipped over the ocean to France after 1 month, I think. And then from there on, we were treated very lousy. Particularly, a comrade of mine, Kopinski, was knocked out by the mob of Cherbourg. You know, when we came down from the ship, they just waited there. They bang! And they knocked him out, and he was quite a time in hospital. He lost his consciousness, everything.
Who knocked him out?
Young French soldiers, you know, never having been in war, 17 years old, and the mob of Cherbourg.
Did you see it?
Sure. I was lucky enough. I was on that ship, you know, was a hell of an air and smelling underneath. We were not allowed to stay on deck. But approaching the harbor of Cherbourg, they called up, and I was just in the line. I said, come up. And I had to take some paperwork for medical paperwork, you know, for their, I don't know, hospital clinics. And from there on, I was considered to be a Red Cross man. You know, I had this. And we were the first one taken from the ship, put on a truck, and taken to the camp with all our lists and whatever they had.
Was there nobody to protect you from this?
There were guards, certainly guards. There were guards, and there were French guards, and American guards also. And the other ones had to stay in line and form a formation and to run 6 kilometers to the camp. And there were some Italian prisoners and German prisoners and Kubinski, and they discovered him, and he unfortunately had his wound here. You know?
In his chest.
Yes, and they hit him with a gun, right over the head, and he collapsed and blood all over. And then he had a lot of brain problems later on for years. And I was in the camp and waited for them, you know. And all of a sudden, a friend of mine came. He was almost crying. He's like, I can't anymore. They had to run with all this, you know. We came from winter. We had flying boots and what you had. And a car came with a jacket full of blood, with the insignia of a mage, of a captain. I knew we only have one captain in our group. This is Kopinski. It must be he. And so it was. He was really knocked out and not even later on he became a 104 pilot. General. But in those days, he was in a very, very bad situation.
So this would have been May 19.
This is 45, May, June 45. And then we were in this camp, and all of one day I got a call, Major Roll, pack you, 15 minutes at the main gate. Okay, you never know what's happened. We were in tens, there were thousands of prisoners. And I was taken to Cherbourg, and pretty soon an airplane, a beach car from the Royal Air Force came and picked me up and took me to Tangmere. And the first man I run in, you know, I was with Rudel, the Stuka Rudel, and he had one artificial leg and stretches, you know. And he came with this, how do you know, stretch or scratches? This one?
Stretches.
And his artificial leg and his, and his back. And he was taken by the air police because we came early and taken to the local prison of that of Tangmere at the main gate. But they left the doors open. They said, "Oh, that's a good sign." If they left the doors open, we could communicate and with the guard. And after 5 minutes, a very smart wing commander came and said, "I'm so sorry, you came earlier than expected, and certainly you are the wrong place. Come with me." This was Wing Commander Stanford Tuck. And he treated us very, very gentlemanlike, and he took us to the officer's mess. And, you know, and from there on we stayed for 3 weeks there and for interrogation. And
what did they want to know?
Everything. Tactics and what everything about aviation was of interest. And from there I went back to Cherbourg again, and pretty soon I was released then to Germany, because I told them I have these problems for my shutdown and for my broken back, and I was written no duty and released and was on a train back to Germany to Bamberg. In Bamberg we were released with a stamp from Flair, and I went home and met my wife then in Bad Wörishofen. This was the end of the story.
When you were interrogated, did you answer freely, or did you hold back?
No, absolutely freely. because this was gone, you know. Strangely enough, we had a great sympathy for the West, you know. And there was a slight thinking that, you know, when the war came closer and closer to Germany, it's like, oh, Jesus Christ, let's turn around and go, under all conditions, with the West against the Russians. This was one irrational thinking, but anyhow, it was. So the sympathy was with the West, not with the East.
When did you, do you remember the month when you finally ceased to be a prisoner?
This was October 45. I came home, October 45, yes.
Can I go back to when you were attacking the American bombers?
I attacked the fighters.
I
was supposed to engage the
fighters.
Yeah.
Which of the American fighters did you fear the most?
P-51. Even if it was shut down by the P-47. The P-47 was a very heavy aircraft. And I think P-38, we could manage the P-38. Even if it was a beautiful aircraft, I flew it. And I always said I would fly on vacation, but beautiful, you know, two engines, lots of foam, and beautiful. But as a fighting machine, I think the most dangerous was the P-51.
What was your attitude towards the enemy during the war, the different enemies? Did you hate the enemy or respect them or what?
You know, we respected the, this is an attitude of all aviators, you know, that they respect the enemy. And as I mentioned, even the Russians didn't respect us. We were the enemies, understandably, you know, we invaded the country. But we treated them as respected opponents. There was no hate as such against the Royal Air Force. You know, there are a lot of Royal Air Force. You know the story of Bader. He was treated very well. We sent a telegram over them and a radio call and said, please come over and chop the artificial legs of Bader. He's here, and they are, but at the impact, they get broken. So the same is true to every nation in the West. There was no hate, not at all. There was a deep respect.
Was the, as far as the Luftwaffe was concerned, was the war in the air fought in a gentlemanly manner or a ruthless manner?
No, I mean, in a gentleman. This is a matter of air forces, you know. I don't blame anybody else. It's their own attitude towards in a fight. I think, and I'm happy, the fighter fight was the most gentleman's fight in a duel situation, if you want. You know, maybe there was the last one that we experienced this in the last war. I think it will never happen, because this personal touch to your opponent, you don't have it with a modern aircraft. You have to pick him up on a radar scope and launch your missile on a distance. Even you can see the guy. This was the last chance, and the first was in World War I, Richthofen. You know, when they started the fight and saluted. You know, we could afford that, you know. You have to get a better position. This is much more important than to swing your sword up and down. But you can overdo it. But there were still some relics of a gentleman like Stuhl.
So would anybody have shot down a pilot coming down in a parachute?
This was strictly forbidden in our case. I don't put my hand in a fire, you know, not on either side. If a pilot gets emotional or by incident, it could happen. I never experienced this, and it was forbidden by rule, written in the German flying pass. But, you know, I've showed you I can show you the picture here. Zwernemann, you know, he was in my wing, in my coupe. He was an NCO, and he got the oak leaves, a very successful fighter pilot. He was transferred to the home defense over Germany. And he got a unit in northern Germany, and he was engaged in a big bomb raid. He was shut down. He bailed out, yeah? And he came down with a parachute with a bullet through his head, dead. It's a firm indication he was shot at the parachute. With a bullet through his head, he cannot pull the parachute anymore. So this happens. Can happen. The question is whether this is a system, a principle, or not. And certainly in the German Air Force, this was absolutely forbidden. And I think in your Air Force too. But I know, in some books, and I don't quote them right now, because a man is a good friend of mine, he's an American pilot, and he writes in his book, you know, that they chase the farmers in the field in North Germany. Yeah? That's ruthless. That's awful. We didn't do that. The civilians were good. I mean, whether you can be misled in your attachment from the air, you cannot differ between a soldier and a civilian, maybe, just by incident. But willing just to and have your fun, that's impossible.
When you were attacking an enemy aircraft, was there any particular method which you always used, or usually used, in attacking an enemy aircraft, or did it always vary with the circumstances?
That's it. You aim for a certain position, but the circumstances are always different. You know exactly, for instance, in Russia, you know, there was an EL-2. You have a certain name in NATO. I forgot that. We called them EL-2. There was a medium bomb, a light bomber, with two-man crew, the pilot and the gunner, and designed for counterattack, heavily armed, on the side underneath, and heavily armed to the back. When we attacked the EL-2, easily, if you approach him right from the back, certainly you shot off the gunner, yeah. But the aircraft is still flying. You never get it down. There was a possibility to get him from an angle off, a little bit, and hit him between engine and cockpit. There it was. So, I mean, as an example. In other case, you know, the fighter aircraft, you just hit it. A bomber, you go for the engine, or you come in and get the gun on, then the engine. The position is always different. I mean, basically, come out from a higher position and come out from the sun that they could see you, if you have the choice. But in many, many cases, you just run into it and you have to take the fight wherever you are forced to do.
One of the things which we see from the books is the number of victories which German pilots had, which are so much more than the number of victories which the British and American pilots had. Yeah. Why do you think this is so? Because some people think that the German figures may not be correct.
They are proved to be correct by the Royal Air Force and by all the others. But the system was different, you know? For instance, Americans. Americans flew 50 missions, then back home. Maybe they got another term, but not 5.5 years, as we. Same is true to the Royal Air Force. They flew 200 hours or whatever it was, and was pulled back. We didn't have enough pilots, so we let the successful pilots be in their units until the dead end. We couldn't take them out because we couldn't replace them. These different front lines which we had, there was too few fighter pilots, experienced fighter pilots. And this is one of the occasions. Even, we got heavily, you know, I'm 3 times, Krupinski 6 times wounded, back to operation, you know. And last week I was together, he jumped 7 times. He was in a hanging out parachute. He was picked up in the North Sea or the British Channel, Bear twice, and put him in action again. They could afford to miss us. We had to stay there. And this is a reason why we run up to these figures, and certainly the opportunity to find a target. You know, that's I talked to many Americans, say they flew 50 missions and they never saw an enemy in the air. It happens. If you fly 10 missions in Russia, you have 10 times you see the target. This is first thing is to be successful, to have a target. And in Russia, you had the targets more than you like.
Was it easier to score victories on the Eastern Front than on the Western Front?
Yes, at least at the beginning. The Russian Air Force was not certainly not the level of the Royal Air Force as far as experienced pilots and equipment is concerned. This was not that level. I can't tell about the French because it didn't show up very much. The only one was with this P-36, which was American equipment. I never ran into a French-built fighter. And when the Americans came in, the German Air Force was already broken. And from, let's say, from 44 onwards, where the big bomb threats were, from 44 onwards, the young pilots which came to the combat wing, not the old experience, but the young pilots, and we changed every day, the norm, the standard, the average survivability was 3 missions, and the pilot was dead. This was murder. We knew that. I knew exactly when I took off in the home defense, 50% will not return from that mission. It's exactly what we knew. That was standard. And this is not, it's not fun anymore, no? So this was a very, very rude war from there on.
So in view of all this, what you've just been saying, yeah? People like yourself who'd flown almost continuously for so many years, you must have been the most experienced combat pilots flying in the air in, of any side in the war.
I will tell you, even the most combat... Many, what we say, many dogs are the death of the hare, you know? Even when the Americans came in, when I lost my thumb, you know, we were 75 fighters. On the radar scope, 800 bombers, which is about 1 hour continuous float in the air, 1,100 fighters, forward fighters, escort fighters, back, taken up, relay. This was filmed from the Harz Mountains down to Stuttgart. In every altitude. When we came down, gear down, no ammunition, red light, no fuel. You forced to come in, and here were the Mustang. We lost many airplanes right in the final approach to the base, where they never could maneuver. So you could get the most experienced pilot. We lost them. We lost in this Bodenplatte, you know what you call Bodenplatte? It was a big attack, counterattack, 1st January 45.
The Ardennes offensive.
No, this was to the North German, North French, Belgium, and Netherlands bases. Yeah, the ground attack. 58 unit leaders. Unit leaders, squadron leaders. Group leaders, wing commanders, 58. This was a dead out. This was experienced pilots, just lost them. So, you know, 5.5 years in operation. This means 15 months in hospital out of this, you know. I was 15 months in hospital.
In your flying in the war, did you come into contact with foreign pilots, allied pilots with the Germans?
Yes, we had under my command, I had in Russia a Hungarian squadron. I had for quite a time a Croatian squadron. And some other group of mine, they had Slovakians with them. Edu Neumann, he was very close attached to the Italians. He was in North Africa and fought all the battle back in Italy. With the Italian force which came with us, you know, there was a split. Some stick with Badoglio, and they called it the Southerners, and the other was the Northerners. And they ended up in the Munich area and went home by car.
After the war, did you suffer any discrimination because of having been in the Air Force?
From the Germans, sure. You know, I was not allowed to go to university, for instance. You know, I wanted, you know, I was influenced for my wife, medicine and so, and I was a little bit, I knew what's on. And I wanted to study medicine in Tübingen. And from the highest German official, he said to me verbally, I don't name him, he's dead in the meantime. He was a great politician, no doubt. And I don't blame him in those days, because it was of the French control. I talked to him and said, I want to get, and why do you want to study to do this? And he says, no, I want to become a medical doctor. And I talked for 1 hour, and then finally he said, listen, Mr. Rall, you are an outstanding, a highly decorated warrior. And you would, if you will or not, you would be a focus point, Kristallisationspunkt, for political, unsafe individuals and characters. And we can't afford that out. So I was not allowed to study. Then I went to a factory, you know. And the first one, I went to practice in a textile factory in the Reutlingen area. And I came, what we call Betriebsrat, you know, union and the thing. So the what? Officer, out. This was the beginning. Certainly changed over the years. And then I was with Siemens and then made a very fine career with Siemens. And then I went to the Salem School and took over the whole organization of Salem School. This was then... but the first reactions after war was very bad, you know. In a time period of 6 months before the war, you were the hero. Then the great cut and cesura came, and you were nothing. But I think this is the norm. I don't blame anybody, you know. Germany was broken, and it's always